Topic number two. For many years, American strategic defense strategy has been based on a concept called mutual assured destruction, or MAD, M-A-D. The idea here is that should either the Soviet Union or the United States launch a nuclear attack on the other, the victim of the attack would be able to destroy the attacker in return. In this concept, furthermore, the targets are cities, not military targets such as enemy missile installations. An ICBM attack under these conditions would have only one basic purpose, to kill tens of millions of innocent civilians. This is the so-called balance of terror we often hear about. In World War II, Hitler used V-1 buzz bombs and V-2 missiles in exactly this way, against the civilian population of England, instead of against military targets, thinking to terrorize England into submission. But as we all know, it didn't work. The British learned to dig into bomb shelters, absorb the civilian deaths and damage, and meanwhile redoubled their efforts at military installations to strike back at Hitler in more important ways. The MAD, Mutual Terror Defense Strategy, is nothing more than a nuclear age version of the very technique that was proven to be useless over 30 years ago. We've all heard countless times, quote, the last thing the Soviet Union would ever want is a nuclear exchange with the United States, unquote. This comforting statement tends to make one accept the foolish MAD defense doctrine if it is to be believed, but it is wrong. The announcement by Nikita Khrushchev in 1956 that all-out war was not inevitable with the West after all appeared to be a renunciation of a basic Leninist principle, but it was not. It was simply the beginning of an elaborate 20-year ploy to make us lower our guard, so that when the inevitable all-out conflict did come, the Soviet Union would be in a position to win. History is repeating itself. In the late 1930s, many people made the mistake of believing that Hitler did not actually want war, but was willing to risk it in order to obtain concessions. So the concessions were made with the idea that this would prevent war. Only too late was it realized that Hitler was determined to have a war one way or another. In the past, the Soviet Union has been notably cautious when skirting the fringes of a possible nuclear war, but that was while she was still at a disadvantage militarily. Now, for the first time, the Soviets are emerging into a totally new situation in which their military power is second to none. With the rapid collapse of free governments now occurring around the globe, the overall correlation of forces, as they call it, is shifting rapidly in favor of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is now number one in military power, while the United States is number two. A situation that has never existed before. The time is now ripe for the Soviets to press their advantage in an effort to seize control of the world. The standing threat from Red China is often mentioned hopefully as a major factor tending to offset any Soviet ideas of waging major war against us, but this too is in error. The Soviet fear of Red China, far from acting as a brake, is spurring them on. Right now, Red China is leaning on the United States. But should the United States be knocked out of action by a Soviet hammer blow before China could take advantage of the situation, China would then be isolated. Red China would then have no choice but to patch things up with the Soviet Union and cooperate, at least on pragmatic matters. Of course, with the United States defeated and the two communist superpowers joining forces once again, the fate of the rest of the world would no longer be in question. Thus, as I stated in monthly audio letter number 15, if we fall, the world falls, and that is the basis of Soviet strategy. Thus, the Soviet Union does want nuclear war with the United States, provided the Soviet Union is prepared to survive with losses limited to acceptable levels, and provided the United States can be destroyed as a military rival in the process. The Soviet rulers emphatically do not think of nuclear war as something that could only happen as the unwanted result of a confrontation, even though this is how we tend to think of it. To them, war, including nuclear war, is a tool of conquest to be used whenever it is advantageous to do so. People have asked the question, why would the Soviet Union plant underwater missiles in our waters when they already have ICBMs, missile-launching submarines, and so forth? Even some officials who know about the Soviet missiles raise this question in various forms as a smokescreen to create doubt. But once you understand the basic Soviet viewpoint I have described, the reasons for the planting of underwater missiles become far easier to grasp. To begin with, the underwater missiles constitute a first strike capability for the Soviet Union. That is, they are concentrated on military targets. Specifically, they are intended to wipe out our naval bases, major ports, and a good fraction of our naval fleet in one sudden surprise blow without advance warning. This type of first strike is quite different from those usually discussed, but would be extremely effective. Consider the choice faced by an American president immediately after such a sudden strike by the Soviet Union by means of its underwater missiles, followed by a Soviet ultimatum to surrender. True, the American naval forces at sea around the world at the time of the attack would be unaffected, and our missile subs could give the Soviet Union an unpleasant pasting. Even our ICBMs might still be available to fire. But what then? First, the damage we could now inflict on the Soviet Union would be minimized by the mammoth civil defense preparations that have been underway in the Soviet Union for 5 years and more. If the president did choose to counterattack, several million Soviet citizens would possibly die, and a small portion of the military and industrial facilities of the Soviet Union, not underground, would be destroyed. But the vast majority of the Soviet population would survive our counterattack, as would a large part of their military industrial complex. Now it would be their turn again. The price we would pay for disobeying the Soviet ultimatum would be awesome. A salvo of ICBMs, not the whole Soviet ICBM force, perhaps but a few hundred nonetheless, would rain down on the United States, hitting both military targets and big cities. Thanks to the well-named mad defense strategy we have followed, we have no civil defense, and the carnage would be beyond imagination, especially since Soviet nuclear warheads are many times more powerful than ours. As for our naval forces, attacks by Soviet anti-ship cruise missiles would rapidly take their toll, and the inability to return to port for fuel and more weapons would cause our Navy to wither away as a fighting force. It would only be a matter of time until our vital sea lanes of commerce were totally destroyed. The process might continue perhaps for some time, but the outcome would not be in doubt. The Soviet Union would be able to outlast us and outblast us once the initial crucial strike against our Navy was made with the underwater missiles. The secret of success of the Soviet plan is their use of a weapon system that would enable the first strike against our Navy to be a complete surprise with extremely reliable results. The greatest possible surprise, of course, would have been achieved if our Navy had never even known the missiles were there off our shores until the moment they were fired. That was the surprise element that my monthly audio letters number 14 and 15 were intended to remove last summer. Another element of surprise has to do with the warning time if a missile is actually launched. With ICBMs, satellite surveillance can provide a warning time of 20 minutes or so, plenty of time to launch our own missiles in retaliation if the decision is made to do so. Submarine-launched ballistic missiles may cut the warning time to a few minutes. But in the case of the short-range underwater launch missiles, there is virtually no warning at all. Since they must travel only a short distance, and the time of flight is brief. By the time they are detected and our defenses alerted, they will be exploding over their targets. There is only one other kind of warning, which is probably the most important of all, advance warning of impending attack through intelligence channels and through reading the meaning of political tensions. Up to now, for example, NATO defense planning has assumed that any attack on Western Europe by the Soviet Union would be preceded by a warning of at least 3 weeks. And 35 years ago, there were several advance warnings before the attack on Pearl Harbor, beginning a week or so ahead of time. But at that time, these warnings were deliberately blocked at high levels of the United States government because certain individuals wanted to ensure that the attack did occur. And now, the chance of obtaining advance warning of impending attack is once again reduced thanks to the intelligence gap created by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. When the Soviet Union decides the time is right to attack, they do not intend to telegraph their intentions in advance. In this regard, the underwater missiles lurking along our shores can be invaluable to them. Their ICBMs have too long a warning time and insufficient accuracy and reliability for the Soviet rulers to employ them with full confidence in a worldwide naval Pearl Harbor attack, such as I described in monthly audio letter number 15. And if they chose to use their missile launching submarines for that purpose, closing into short range to produce short flight times for their missiles, they would risk alerting our Navy that something was up because of the peculiar deployment of their submarines. On top of that, a worldwide surprise attack of the kind contemplated by the Soviets depends for its success on a simultaneous strike everywhere. Not an easy thing to achieve with missiles launched by numerous submarines all over the world. But the underwater missiles are made to order for a surprise attack. They lurk unseen for days, weeks, or months until they are needed. Then when they are to be fired, the preparations for the attack can be made without any outward sign at all, deep inside a command post in the Soviet Union. To launch the attack itself, a signal need only be flashed worldwide from the command post, while the observable activities of the Soviet Union, military and otherwise, proceed in normal patterns, giving no hint of the impending attack. When the surprise attack plan of the Soviet Union is known, the question is no longer, why would they plant those underwater missiles? The question becomes, why wouldn't they do it? The Soviet Union is prepared to wage war with several times our own nuclear firepower. At the same time, they are prepared to survive such a war as a viable society with population losses of perhaps no more than 2%. That's around 5 million lives, and it is indeed very hard for you and me to imagine deliberately accepting such losses for a political purpose. But remember, the Soviet bosses think their way, not our way, and if they were to suffer losses that large, our own losses could be 50 to 100 million. Provided they have the ability to disable the United States Navy at the outset, with the surprise attack they have planned, the Soviets believe they have little to lose and everything to gain now by their standards in a nuclear war. And that is why the Soviet Union wants nuclear war now. Topic number 3. Since early July 1976, shortwave radio communications worldwide have been disrupted by what one ham radio operator describes as, quote, a super enormous strong signal that sounds like a buzzsaw, unquote. Not only hams have been affected, but maritime, aeronautical, and telecommunications channels have been rendered practically useless in some cases. The signal is a rasping sound that pulses 10 times per second, originating from Soviet transmitters. The monitoring branch of the Federal Communications Commission has received a flood of complaints and has written 4 complaints to Moscow about it without any reply whatsoever. According to Robert Cutts, chief of the FCC's International Operations Division, this silence from the Soviet Union is very unusual. Quote, usually they've been very cooperative, unless there's something particularly unique about this situation, unquote. Indeed, there is something unique about these Soviet radio signals, my friends. They are transmissions between Moscow and Soviet submarines worldwide by means of the advanced communication system I mentioned in a recent monthly audio letter. It is no accident that these signals first began early in July 1976. That was the month when I first revealed the existence of underwater missiles in American and Canadian territorial waters planted by the Soviets. It is also no accident that transmissions like this were first heard in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The government professes not to have any idea what these signals are all about, but they know better. These signals are being used to maintain tight coordination of Soviet naval activities, especially submarine movements, in preparation for war. But one lie leads to another, and just as you are not being told about the Soviet underwater missiles that threaten your life and your freedom, you are not being told the true meaning of the Soviet buzzsaw signals. There are at least 13 transmitters broadcasting these powerful signals, located mostly in Soviet or Soviet-occupied territory. Transmitters are operated in Archangel, Leningrad, Moscow, Kiev, Odessa, Gdansk, the Bosphorus Straits, Rostov, Minsk, Warsaw, Prague, East Berlin, and of all places, Loch Ness in Scotland. The Loch Ness transmitter is aboard a small submarine that entered the northeast end of Loch Ness by means of the canal that connects Loch Ness to Moray Firth. If there wasn't one before, there certainly is a Loch Ness monster now. Compliments of the Soviet Union. These Soviet transmissions make use of a technique known as pulse modulation. Each of the 10 pulses per second sounds like nothing more than a meaningless rasp to the ear, but in fact, each pulse contains a superimposed signal in code. The possible codes are endless, and a computer is required both to create the coded pulses for transmissions and to decode them where they are received. Therefore, unless and until intelligence information becomes available on the details of the exact code, it is practically impossible to intercept and understand the Soviet messages to their subs. But matters even more blatant than the Soviet mysterious signals are being hidden from you. For example, do you know about the joint Soviet and Cuban naval and aviation maneuvers that took place from September 15 to September 23, 1976 in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico? These war games utilized not only the new Soviet submarine base at Cienfuegos Harbor, not far from the United States Naval Station at Guantanamo Bay, but also Mario and Havana, right across from Florida. These war exercises carried a clear threat for the Panama Canal, Puerto Rico, and our base at Guantanamo Bay, and in addition, ranged all along our Gulf Coast as far west as Galveston, Texas. Yet our so-called Defense Department said not one word about it, and our sleeping press, following the non-existent lead of our controlled major media, said nothing about it either. Since Red Friday, October 1, 1976, our military, from General George S. Brown on down, have been muzzled, ordered to flatly deny charges about Soviet missiles in our waters if pressed to comment on them. Meanwhile, top-secret civil defense exercises are now underway here in Washington, D.C., and other sensitive areas for top government officials only, while the rest of our people are left in the dark, not only without protection, but without even any official warning that war could be imminent. But the last straw came in just the past several days, my friends. Last month, I reported that immediately after the Red Friday capitulation by President Ford to the Soviet demands advanced by Andrei Gromyko, Soviet submarines along our east and west coasts performed a chemical warfare experiment. Clouds of radioactive plutonium were released into our atmosphere to drift inward and contaminate the United States, while the United States government cooperated by claiming that we were being plastered with radioactive fallout from a Chinese nuclear test 10 days earlier. As I reported last month, we were spared major effects from that experimental plutonium release due to weather conditions that did not behave as predicted by the Soviets. But now they are poised to do it again. On Wednesday, November 17th, a large Chinese atmospheric hydrogen bomb test was announced, and immediately we were inundated with announcements that the radioactive cloud would reach our west coast only 3 short days later, today, November 20th, 1976. Last time, they claimed that the Chinese cloud took 10 days to cover the same distance, but that was because the Soviet subs were not ready at that time to use the Chinese blast as a cover for their chemical attack against us. This time, they can hardly wait. As of noon yesterday, November 19th, 18 Soviet submarines were deployed at even intervals along our west coast within about 35 miles of our shoreline. They are not missile launchers, but are equipped specifically for the injection of plutonium into our air today. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is telling us not to fear the Chinese nuclear cloud alleged to be passing over our country, but is cooperating completely with the Soviet Union in providing a totally false cover for the Soviet radioactive plutonium attack on our country. In actual fact, the radioactivity created by the Chinese test itself has not yet gone beyond Red China's own borders. The media are reminding us how terrible swine flu might be, and we are also being told of the disappointingly low number of eligible Americans who are taking the free government swine flu shots. We are told that swine flu, if it breaks out, could spread like wildfire. And now, certain persons in the United States government are cooperating with the Soviet Union in an attack on our nation by means of radioactive plutonium, the effects of which can be mistaken for severe flu if intended dosages are achieved. My friends, the so-called mysterious signals from the Soviet Union stopped temporarily on November 2nd, but then on November 10th, they started up again because Soviet war preparations were resuming. Since I talked with you last, 36 new missiles have been planted in our waters in addition to those I referred to last month. I have not given the locations of these to anyone, and for now, I do not intend to do so. Now let me tell you why. On one hand, there are those factions within the shell of a government left here in Washington who are actively cooperating with the Soviet Union. Some of these are outright Soviet agents. Others are part of the corporate socialist network that cooperates with the Soviets for mutual advantage at the expense of the rest of us. Some in this second group still do not believe that a Soviet double cross has been underway for months in the form of the underwater missiles in our waters. On the other hand, there are many who are honestly trying to counter the Soviet underwater missile threat, acting within constraints imposed on them. Prior to October 1st, missiles were being removed as they were planted by the Soviet Union, acting on information I was providing to General George S. Brown and to military intelligence. In this capacity, I have been acting as an information channel to go around the intelligence gap created by Henry Kissinger. But where is all this leading? What will happen if traitors in our midst continue to cover up the truth about the Soviet underwater missiles? And if patriots in our government cannot summon the courage to tell the truth regardless of the consequences? What is going to happen if that situation continues, my friends, is thermonuclear war and dictatorship here in America. Even if the United States Navy were to continue removing Soviet missiles as they are planted, which they have been ordered not to do since October 1st, this would not prevent disaster. The Soviet Union is able to plant missiles far faster than we can remove them. So the information I have been relaying is really being used now for just one purpose, to enable our leaders to keep abreast of the chances of attack and to minimize those chances until they are ready to run and hide in the 96 underground cities of the Federal Relocation Arc to ride out the war. Then war can come, scorching the land and consuming our people. The top secret information provided me by my sources, often at the risk of their own lives, is not intended for the private use of cold-blooded traitors and spineless leaders in the American government. It is intended to bring about exposure of the truth as the one and only thing that can prevent a war. If war comes, it will be a devastating surprise to most Americans. The perverse behavior of our public officials in misusing my information threatens to condemn millions of us to a nuclear holocaust. Therefore, it is only right that they condemn themselves at the same time. Without the missile locations I am now withholding, they too will be caught in the lightning surprise attack by the Soviet Union that threatens to engulf the rest of us. Millions of our lives apparently mean nothing at all to them compared to their service to the Soviet Union and their jobs and their pensions. But now their lives are at stake along with the rest of us. Only if the truth about the Soviet underwater missiles is exposed will I turn over the new information I have, on which not only our lives, but theirs too, now depend. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.